This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It's the biggest democratic exercise in the world. Over the last 6 weeks, an estimated 900 million eligible voters got to cast their ballots in the Indian election. Electoral officials climb mountains and traverse glaciers so even the most remote communities can take part. And it seems that the incumbent party and its leader Narendra Modi have won another term and won it decisively. So in this briefing room, I want to know what were the issues and what does the outcome tell us about Modi's India? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy some of our other episodes, including ones on Huawei, opioids and homelessness, to name but three. You can find all of them on BBC Sounds. It's the biggest democratic exercise in the world. The six-week-long Indian elections are over and the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP, has won a decisive victory, meaning its leader, Narendra Modi, will have a second term as Prime Minister. What difference has he made so far and what does this new victory mean for India and the world? Step inside the briefing room to find out. Now, I can say that the Indian elections are a great event, but that just doesn't convey the scale of it. So earlier, I spoke to a former Chief Election Commissioner of India, Dr. S.Y. Qureshi. He was in our Delhi studio. Dr. Qureshi, just how big are the Indian elections?
Indian elections are the biggest elections in the world. Not just the biggest elections, but the biggest event of any kind. We have 900 million voters. We have 1 million polling stations. We have 12 million polling staff. And we have to conduct it in very, very adverse and diverse situations. There are some places where it takes polling parties to walk 3 days to reach the polling station. And of course, they use all kinds of transport from camels and elephants and boats and cycles and trains and helicopters, whatever it takes.
Now, it must be incredibly difficult for political parties to campaign amongst all those people, to get ballot papers out to all the polling stations. I imagine things must be going wrong all the time.
We work on the Murphy's Law that if things can go wrong, they will. And the challenge for us is to make sure that we have a plan B and a plan C and a plan D ready, which is why we are able to manage almost foolproof election every time.
With an election so vast, how do you stop malpractice going on? I mean, how do you stop people being intimidated on the way to vote?
We have a lot of security on public demand, on the demand of all political parties. We deploy, in addition to the state police, central armed police force. Since they are outsiders, when they go to the state and they don't know the language, nobody knows them, so they are not vulnerable to any political pulls and pressures, which is also the reason why we do elections in many phases, because the number of forces which are available to us is limited. So we use the same force repeatedly, you know, in rotating from one phase to the other.
Now, in your experience, what were some of the most remarkable problems and obstacles that you faced?
Security is always a major issue, particularly in some of our pockets of India. For instance, left-wing extremists, the Maoists, in some states like Bihar, Chhattisgarh, Andhra Pradesh, even pockets of Maharashtra. And then we have militancy in northeast, in Manipur, Nagaland. Then we have terrorism and militancy in Jammu and Kashmir. So these are areas which require special attention.
And what is the most remote polling station in India?
There is a polling station which is 1,200 kilometers from India's mainland and just about 200 kilometers from Indonesia in the Andaman and Nicobar Islands. In Ladakh, in Jammu and Kashmir, we have a polling station at the height of 16,000 feet, which is the highest polling station.
How many people vote in a place like that?
There are two villages, 2-3 kilometers apart. Together, last election, there were 37 voters.
So you have a polling station set up at 16,000 feet, miles away from anywhere, for 37 voters.
Yes, exactly. In fact, in 2009 general election, our polling party could not reach these two polling stations because of bad weather. Even Indian Air Force helicopters which tried to land there made 4 attempts and failed. So then we decided that we'll send 2 parties. Normally it is a team of 5, but in this case we added 1 more, 6 each, so 12 people started walking. They took 3.5 days to reach there. Our next problem was, after the poll, it will take them as much time to come back, whereas there is counting the next day. So what will happen? We decided that one party will go to the other village. Together, they will open the machines in front of the citizens, and they will transmit the results to us by satellite phones. So on one hand, we were very worried whether we will be able to conduct the poll there. It happened that the first result known in the country were those 37 votes.
And what's the smallest polling station?
Oh, that's interesting. We have a polling station for just 1 voter in Gir Forest of Gujarat, which is famous for Asiatic lions. So there is a temple priest who lives there. For him, our rule is that nobody should have to walk more than 2 kilometers to the polling station. So for him, a polling party of 6 goes the previous evening, sets up the polling station. Then next morning, we wait for him to come any time of his choice. Last time, he came around 2 o'clock. Even after he has voted, we cannot pack up and go, because technically, somebody may come later and challenge his vote and say that guy who came in the morning was a bogus voter, I'm the real voter.
So how many people were involved in trying to get this one person's vote in the end?
A standard configuration of a polling party is 6 people. So 6 of them go there and to capture 1 vote.
Dr. S.Y. Qureshi, before looking to the future, I want an assessment of how Narendra Modi has done so far. When he was elected in 2014, there were big worries about his effect on relations between the Hindu majority and the religious minorities, not least because when he was Chief Minister of Gujarat State, Mr. Modi was heavily criticised for failing to contain anti-Muslim violence, in which around 1,000 people were killed. But did those fears materialise? Here's Shautik Biswas, a BBC reporter based in Delhi.
Modi was born the son of a tea stall owner in Gujarat, and according to one biographer, he didn't have any special bond either with his family or friends. And very early in his life, he joined the right-wing Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is called the RSS, and it's widely regarded as the parent organization of the BJP. Now, what is the RSS? It was founded in 1925. And most importantly, it believes in the unity and protection of India's majority Hindus. And today, you know, the RSS has some 6,000 full-time workers. Some 2 million people participate in 80,000 branches across the country. So it's a fairly big organization. And you have to remember that the BJP is also a political affiliate of the RSS. It believes in Hinduatva, which is an ideology seeking to establish the supremacy of the Hindus and the Hindu way of life. The fact is that he rode to power, I think, mainly in 2014 on the back of a very poor performance by the Congress, but he also inspired and fired up the imagination of the people by appealing as a strong, muscular Hindu nationalist leader. India is overwhelmingly a Hindu-majority country. India has about 170 million Muslims of the 1.3 billion people that we have. So the fact is that Mr. Modi and his BJP party's very strident Hindu nationalism has left the country polarized and the minority is nervous, you know. We are seeing a shift from fairly benign civic nationalism to some kind of ethno-nationalism or a ethnic democracy. You know, when they're conflating religion with nationalism, that's a giant stride because it divides the country, it sends out very divisive messages, there's a lot of dog whistle politics, and minorities feel nervous. I think Hindu nationalism has taken some fairly insidious forms since 2014 when the BJP came to power. There have been attacks on Muslims suspected to be cow smugglers. Most of India's majority Hindus, a lot of them worship the cow. The cow is a very venerated animal. And cow protection movements date back to 1870s, you know. But with the coming of the BJP, you know, the cow slaughter rules have been made very strict. They've been strengthened. Cow vigilante groups have mushroomed, you know. I'm not saying that these groups have any links with the party, but these vigilante groups, which are often extortion rackets, have mushroomed since the BJP came to power and have attacked Muslims who they suspect have been smuggling cows. There have been lynchings, street names have been changed. Renaming of streets is a very easy and popular thing, which every regime has done in India. And they are doing it. The only difference is that they're changing it from Muslim names to Hindu names. You know, sometimes art and theater shows have been attacked. You know, there was this ruling that cinemas would have to play the national anthem before the movie began. So all these things were there. But I think much more important and much more insidious, really, is how Hindu nationalists, the votaries of Hindu nationalists, the party wants to infiltrate institutions and put their people who are Hindutva sympathizers in their position. So you can infiltrate schools, you can infiltrate colleges, you can infiltrate universities. That, for me, is a much more insidious long-term effect of Hindu nationalism. The BJP used to be a party of the upper caste Hindus. Today, in 2019, they are much more widely accepted across northern, western, and now eastern India. It's a relentlessly expansionist party. What I'm kind of amazed by is his oratory and his kind of very rootsy, folksy oratory, which the English-speaking liberals in India make fun of. But the fact is, he touches a great chord, and his messaging is right, very, very sharp. And he's like a rock star when he comes on stage, where he kind of deftly mixes up development and nationalism and patriotism and you know, the promise of making India safer. And he packs all of this in like under 50 minutes or something. I think he's kind of changed the terms of debate. I don't think we had kind of political debates in before elections been framed in terms of nationalism and patriotism and India's place in the world and India's place in the high table. And these are the things which Modi has kind of brought to the forefront.
Shouting Biswas. So there are still grounds for substantial worry. What about the economy? Progress there was Modi's great promise in 2014. What's actually happened? Down the line from Finland, I'm joined by Kunal Sen, Professor of Economics at United Nations University in Helsinki. Kunal Sen, as far as you could see, what was the biggest economic issue in the Indian elections?
I think the biggest economic issue is probably the fact that there was going to be a lack of job creation that happened in the last 5 years. The data suggests that unemployment had risen to a 45-year high.
When you say it's at a 45-year high, what would explain that?
There are many reasons for that. Possibly the fact that there are many from the villages who are coming to the cities looking for jobs. We also have a problem of farming not being very profitable. Possibly that has led to some more unemployment in the rural areas, not enough jobs in the cities, and perhaps a farming crisis in rural India.
Is there a significant young population that is finding it hard to find jobs?
That's exactly what's the real problem. What we have in India is a fairly young population. It's a population that's more educated than certainly 10, 20 years back, who are quite keen to get reasonably well-paid jobs in the cities. When they come to cities and they look around, there aren't enough jobs that are there for them.
Now, when he first came to power in 2014, what was Narendra Modi's plan for creating jobs and creating economic growth to provide those jobs?
I think he realized that manufacturing needed to be revived. So he tried to take a few steps. The one was a very famous Make in India program, which was really to try and make it easier for business to invest in India. There was some improvement in that, but there were other challenges. So this has to do with things like skills, infrastructure, how India's labor laws needed to be reformed. On those other areas, perhaps there wasn't much progress.
He succeeded in some ways in trying to kind of free up the economy from overregulation and bureaucracy, but still didn't manage to reskill the workforce.
Exactly. I think that reskilling of the workforce, especially this relatively young workforce, was a huge problem. He tried to do something about it through what is called the Skill India program. My sense is that program still hasn't done very much. Perhaps that might change now that we know that Modi is going to be in power for the next 5 years.
What would he have to do in order to be able to do that?
I think the main issue would be to try and have partnerships with the private sector. Modi still is, interestingly enough, somebody who believes in the state doing everything. But when it comes to skilling, what you need to do is work with the private sector. Modi needs to work not just with the big corporate sector, but also the small-scale enterprises.
Who would you say has benefited most during the course of Modi's first 5 years?
He has done a fairly good job in providing a lot of things that the rural population likes to see: sanitation, infrastructure, electrification, housing. Sanitation is a major challenge in the villages. India has one of the highest open defecation rates in the world. That has led to lots of different health problems. So Modi, when he came to power, this was a program that he really seemed to be very committed to, the Swachh Bharat Abhiyan, which he really pushed in this first few years in power in a systematic way. And we now know, looking at the numbers, that there was quite a remarkable increase in rural sanitation around the country. So I think that there were some tangible benefits which they could see. And I do think that certainly had a role to play in the fact that the BJP has done so well in this elections.
One of the programs we made in the early days of the briefing room was about the extraordinary demonetization in India. And it seemed to be a very controversial policy. So perhaps we ought to follow up with you and find out how it went.
Well, I think there's no question now. I mean, we seem to have a very good sense of the economic loss that happened after demonetization. I mean, when you remove cash of that order of magnitude from the economy in a one-shot situation, and then when the new currencies hadn't come in for quite some time, working poor are working in the informal sector in India. That's around 85% of the workforce. And in both agriculture and in the informal sector, cash suddenly disappeared. And when cash disappears, then, you know, pretty much you have to stop your production completely. And so there was a big contraction in the economy, which particularly hit the working poor, I would say, quite severely. Estimates of the contraction is around 1.5% GDP. One might say, well, if that's what happened, then what explains the support? And this is born out of my own interviews which I did in villages in India after the demonetization policy, is that many people said, well, you know, we suffered, but we think that the rich person in my village suffered more. And if they've suffered more, I'm actually supporting of this policy because nobody before has done something seriously about corruption. So I think that political narrative on this particular policy actually helped Modi.
I don't think I've ever heard such an explanation for a phenomenon like that. That's very interesting. Do the young people we were talking about earlier, do they think things are going to get better?
The young people who, as I was saying, still looking for jobs, we haven't seen job creation that is in the last 5 years, the kind that we think that Modi promised when he came to power. But they do believe that Modi can deliver on these jobs. So I think the sense is that this aspirational youth who are more educated than before do see that Modi will be able to deliver that in the next 5 years. The fact that he hasn't done that yet doesn't seem to have had a negative effect on their own voting preferences.
Kunal Sen. Finally, and looking forward, I want to know about India's global ambitions and what the Modi victory might mean for the rest of the world. So earlier I spoke to James Crabtree, an expert on India at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy and author of The Billionaire Raj. He was in Singapore. And joining us too was Nirupama Rao. She was Foreign Secretary of India from 2009 to 2011 and ambassador to both the United States and China. She was on the line from Mumbai. When it comes to India's foreign policy and its standing in the world, What has Narendra Modi tried to do differently from his predecessors?
I think when it comes to style, and not substance so much, but style, definitely it's been very different. He's been an activist. He's been what you would call in Sanskrit a real yogi about it. He's shown up. He's been much more visible. His media and communication strategy has been so much more effective, especially in the Gulf region and in relations with Japan. And just the image of a rising India, I think he's been able to articulate with considerable success.
So that's, if you like, a kind of modernization of communication and a modernization of the projection of the country is differently. James Crabtree, a decade ago, there was a lot of talk, and I remember it well, about the sleeping economic giant awakening and transforming the world. In many ways, that talk seems to have died down a bit. How would you explain that?
When Modi was elected in 2014, he came with huge hopes for very rapid economic transformation of India's fortune. He was seen to be a business-friendly leader. He had run the state in India that he used to run before becoming prime minister as a sort of competent, technocratic, business-friendly reformer. However, his record in office has been much more mixed. India is the world's fastest growing major economy and has been for much of the last few years. It's overtaken China. And so on the surface, things look impressive. But actually, his record as an economic reformer has been much more mixed. This raises quite significant issues about whether he's going to be able to do more in his second term than he managed in his first.
How much should a country like Britain or other partners be looking to India as being a driver of the world economy in the near future?
I think that's a very good question. So a lot of people have hoped as China's growth slows, they hope India's going to take over that position. And eventually it will, but you have to understand that India and China are not the same thing. India is a much poorer country. It has a GDP per capita of less than $2,000, which is a quarter of the size of China. And although India is becoming a much more important part of the global economy than it was a decade ago, it's nowhere near the level that China has reached. And the odds of it being able to repeat a Chinese-style growth miracle with two decades of growth of, you know, in the high single digits or even higher than that, are pretty slim.
Nirupama Rao, let's look at the flashpoints. India's relationship with Pakistan has always been tense, to say the least. It's hard to believe that a nationalist government wouldn't make this more difficult. Has it been?
As far as Pakistan is concerned, Mr. Modi definitely has to renew his focus on the neighborhood, whatever his, you know, his larger inclinations may be on the global stage. This was an election that in some ways was a national security election with Pakistan at its center, and it's really never happened that way before. The question before us is, what is Mr. Modi's Pakistan policy going to be? He's received a huge mandate and an endorsement from the Hindu majority population. What you've seen in over the last few months after the Balakot strikes and then the surgical strikes before that too, is that you have a large cross-section of the population that is displaying its deep frustrations about Pakistan.
Can you just explain Balakot to the listener?
Balakot is essentially a place in Pakistan which was the target of attacks by the Indian Air Force after what had happened in Kashmir, in this place called Fulwama, in early February, where more than 40 Indian paramilitary personnel were killed by a suicide bomber who, it was reported, was a part of one of the Pakistan-based terror groups. That is how the retaliatory attack on this place called Balakot happened. And it was the first time that Indian Air Force planes had crossed the line of control deep into Pakistani territory, to where it was believed the terrorists were located. Mr. Modi has very little alternative but to continue to show a very strong hand. You may see a resumption of dialogue, but I don't believe it can go anywhere unless this basic issue is tackled, at least from India's side, the issue of terrorism.
James Crabtree, what about China? When I was a boy, I seem to remember there was an India-China war. How's China now seen by India?
India's China policy is one that is reasonably tense. In recent history, last year, the two countries had a military standoff in the Himalayas that could have plausibly turned into a war, although it didn't in the end. And there are lots of other tensions. The two countries have very long borders with each other, lots of simmering disputes. And India, much as many other countries around Asia, is very nervous about China's rise. China is the giant in Asia, and it is poking its head into India's backyard in South Asia by building ports and sailing big ships and submarines. And so in general, India is very nervous about China, and over the last two decades has become progressively closer to the United States, not quite an ally, but with many stronger ties. And they have done that because of the fear that China will become the predominant power in Asia. So if you think about China's Belt and Road infrastructure building initiative, it's been doing lots of big, expensive projects, building ports in Myanmar and ports in Sri Lanka, and India doesn't like that at all. And so that comes back to the issue of why India's economic modernization is so important, because if its economy doesn't grow, then it has very little hope of being able to push China back a little bit.
Nirupama Rao, has Modi seen the Trump administration as a hindrance or as something of an opportunity?
Yeah, I was also ambassador to China, so I'm looking at both the relationships. I think China is really going to be the big neighborhood relationship for India, and I don't believe, you know, Indian policymakers can afford to ignore that. When it comes to the United States, I think the relationship is not in a bad place, even if, you know, you discount what the Trump administration is signaling on trade and on immigration. But on the security and strategy front, I think the relationship has grown over the last decade and a half. And I think Mr. Modi will definitely want to grow that relationship.
Narendra Modi's today pulled off a decisive win in the election. Now, do you interpret this as a victory for the BJP or for Modi himself, James Crabtree?
I think this will be seen as a victory for Modi himself. The interesting thing is that this election victory is rather different from the last one. So in 2014, he was elected as an economic modernizer, someone who is going to reform the way the country's economy operated. This victory and the campaign that he's just fought have been much more nationalistic in tone. He hasn't had a great record of miraculous economic success to talk about, and so he's talked about conflict with Pakistan, about external threats to the nation, about he being, if not quite a strongman leader, then the hope for India's strength in the future. And so I think the campaign very much focused around him, and so I think it'll be interpreted as, in a sense, his success.
Is that the way you see it, Nirupama Rao?
Yes, I do. I think it's very much, you know, a victory and endorsement of Mr. Narendra Modi and what he has stood for in the last 5 years. And the people seem to have reposed their fullest confidence in him individually. I can only hope that in the next 5 years, you know, he will be that statesman who is able to rise above divisions, who's able to respect the diversity of India, and who's able to focus on development, and development. As Deng Xiaoping said, development is the core issue. He has to grow beyond the politics from which he originated. I think he has to become India's Deng Xiaoping.
Nirupama Rao there with James Crabtree. My thanks to them and also to S.Y. Qureshi, Shautik Biswas and Kunal Sen. We'll be back in September when, instinct suggests, there'll be a whole lot more to get briefed about. Until then, goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Serena Tarling and Simona Rata. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.